Syria calls on the U.S. Security Council to issue a clear and explicit condemnation of Israeli aggression on its territory. Pakistan declares a state of emergency as more than 30 million people are affected by devastating flooding across much of the country. And at least 23 people are killed in fighting between rival armed groups in the Libyan capital, raising fears of an all-out conflict in the North African country. Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to World News. Syria has called on the UN and the Security Council to issue a clear and explicit condemnation of Israeli aggression on its territory. In a letter addressing the UN chief and head of the Security Council, Syria's foreign ministry recalled some recent Israeli crimes, including an attack on the Damascus International Airport last June. It said the attack caused the airport to go completely out of service for 2 weeks. Ministry noted regime is determined today more than ever to sabotage Syria's infrastructure and endanger the lives of civilians. It said Israeli aggression is a direct threat to regional and international peace and security, adding that Damascus reserves a right to respond to these attacks. Israel frequently carries out missile strikes on Syria. Latest one came Thursday when Israeli jets targeted a research facility in the city of Masyaf. Palestinians in the blockaded Gaza Strip attended a Friday sermon and prayer in front of the Red Cross office to show solidarity with Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. This as last Monday, Palestinian prisoners started protesting their inhumane detention conditions. Ashraf Shannon brings you the latest from the besieged Gaza Strip.
Hundreds of people attended the Friday prayer in front of the Red Cross office in the Gaza Strip, in a move to express their sympathy and unity with Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails and detention centers. They came to drum up support for Palestinian prisoners who kicked off a series of protests last Monday against persistent mistreatment inside regime jails. The event is part of the Friday of Rage in solidarity with Palestinian detainees. During the Friday sermon, Hamas movement warned the Israeli regime against harming Palestinian prisoners.
Our military wings, including the Qassam and Quds brigades, and the military wings of all Palestinian resistance factions, are all united behind the prisoners. We will spare no effort to secure the release of the prisoners. Harming Palestinian prisoners is an attack on all Palestinian resistance factions.
Over the past 4 days, Palestinian detainees held in 24 Israeli prisons have refused to take part in security checks and returned their meals. They also organized sit-ins in prison yards as part of their protest action.
The Israeli prison service reneged on understandings that were previously reached with prisoners' representatives. It imposed punitive measures, including moving tens of detainees to solitary confinement, preventing inmates from going to the prison yard, and banning prisoners from meeting their families. In response to this, the Palestinian prisoners have declared the state of general mobilization last Monday.
In recent weeks, the Israeli prison service increased its oppressive measures against Palestinian prisoners by imposing double isolation on some detainees. Observers say the Palestinian prisoners have become propaganda material for candidates in Israel's elections. Currently, there are some 5,000 Palestinian detainees in Israeli prisons, and that figure includes women and children. According to prisoners' advocacy groups, the Israeli regime has detained more than 1 million Palestinians since the Nakba in 1948, under the watchful eye of the international community. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Yemen's Ministry of Health has voiced deep concern over dire consequences of the Saudi blockade on the war-torn country, affecting the nation's health sector and people. Abdul Latif Al-Washali has more.
The Saudi-led war on Yemen is still taking its toll on the nation, even under the UN-brokered truce. Yemen's Ministry of Health has held a press briefing in Sana'a to highlight the catastrophic repercussions of the Saudi aggression and the impact of the ongoing siege of Yemen. We held this press conference to review the impact of the Saudi aggression since its beginning, as well as the aftermath of the siege amid the UN armistice, which unfortunately did not change anything. There are tragedies caused by the Saudi-led coalition throughout the years of war, as health facilities and workers have been targeted, and we explain to the world what is happening in our country under the eyes of the United Nations and with the support of the US, Britain and the rest of major powers.
The ministry says the ongoing Saudi blockade is threatening the lives of thousands of patients by preventing them from traveling for treatment and blocking medical supplies from entering the country.
The blockade is part of the fierce war on Yemen and has directly affected the health sector due to a lack of fuel and failure to fully open the Sana'a International Airport. There are more than 32,000 patients who urgently need to travel abroad for treatment. Saudi Arabia also tends to prevent the entry of medicines that are essential for the treatment of millions, including radioactive iodine, which is used to treat cancer patients.
Even though the United Nations managed to declare a nationwide ceasefire back in April, it has failed to relieve the humanitarian situation in Yemen, as Saudi Arabia is still imposing restrictions on all sorts of imports into the country.
According to health officials, 19 million Yemenis don't have access to basic health care services. They say the United Nations is concentrating its efforts on the Russia-Ukraine war, while it should also put more efforts into Yemen to save the lives of millions of women and the children.
Pakistan has been grappling with monsoon flooding that swept much of the country. Officials say death toll has almost reached the 1,000 mark since mid-June. Now the government has declared an emergency and mobilized the military. Thousands of residents in critical areas have been ordered to evacuate. Pakistan has called for international help to cope with the aftermath of this disaster. Authorities say this year's monsoon flooding has affected over 33 million people, and nearly a million homes have been destroyed or badly damaged. This year's floods are comparable to those of 2010, the worst on record. That year, over 2,000 people died, and nearly a fifth of the country was underwater.
Monsoon rains are still pounding Pakistan, hampering all sorts of communications in key cities and towns in four provinces of the country. Roads, houses, hotels, and buildings, along with other infrastructures, have been washed away by the flood waters. Southwestern Balochistan and northwestern Khyber Pakhtunkhwa provinces are now in the spotlight due to the sheer magnitude of devastation witnessed there in recent days. That's while millions of Pakistanis ravaged by extreme flooding are still awaiting relief in remote rural areas.
As far as government support is concerned, I think they supported only 50%. A lot of complaints from the local communities that there is no support received so far from the government. They are demanding shelters, food items, and a lot of other things.
Across large swaths of Pakistan, houses, schools, roads, and bridges have been destroyed. Floods also left thousands displaced and struggling to find safety along with their livestock. Meanwhile, Shehbaz Sharif has visited the heavily affected areas. He has already appealed to the international community to send aid and relief to help them deal with the devastation.
We are doing our best to help flood-affected people. The 30 years record of monsoon has been broken this year. The situation is demanding that we all should rise above the politics and to help the flood victims to overcome their miseries.
Pakistan is 8th on the Global Climate Risk Index for being one of the most vulnerable countries in the face of extreme weather caused by climate change. The country witnessed more rain than ever recorded this monsoon season.
Flash floods in Pakistan. The Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi, has offered condolences and expressed sympathy with the country's government and people. In a phone call with the Pakistani Prime Minister, Shehbaz Sharif, Raisi said Iran is ready to provide its neighbor with any kind of help. The Iranian president said that he has tasked relevant bodies with supplying first aid to flood-stricken people of Pakistan. He added that Iran remains a friend to the country in times of hardship and seeks to continue bilateral cordial relations. Shadi, for his part, thanked the Islamic Republic for supporting his country in times of difficulty. A father who lost two of his sons last year during the U.S.'s withdrawal from Afghanistan speaks out on the anniversary of the event. He's blamed the U.S. for their deaths and is demanding an apology and compensation. Our correspondent Abdullah Amrizadeh has filed this report out of Kabul.
It has been a year since the U.S. missile withdrawal from Afghanistan and the Taliban takeover of the country. During the pullout, thousands of Afghans flocked to airports in hope of leaving the country along with the U.S. forces. Zaki was one of them. As the Taliban encircled Kabul on August 15, hundreds of Afghans swarmed the runway of Hamid Karzai International Airport, attempting to climb onto a U.S. Air Force transport plane. Zaki made his way to the front and clambered onto the plane's landing gear. As it accelerated past 120 miles per hour, he held tight. His body was found after he plunged from the U.S. military plane as it took off, one of the most tragic and indelible images in the final chapter of the U.S. campaign in Afghanistan. We spoke to Zaki's father 1 year after his son's death. It wasn't easy to convince him at first, but this is our mission, to be the voice of the voiceless.
I just want to see the pilot of the U.S. plane to understand how he could do this. The U.S. claims that it supports human rights, but this is a sheer lie. They kill innocent people. They have not even apologized to me for my son's death. I've waited for a year for a simple apology, but it never happened.
Zaki's brother, Zabih, also lost his life during the Taliban takeover. Many Afghans blame the U.S. for the loss of innocent Afghan lives during the Washington's withdrawal.
There is no doubt that Americans are responsible for such incidents. They caused a chaos and it got out of their control. They knew such events might occur. Falling from planes or getting killed in explosions were the result of Americans' irresponsibility and mismanagement.
The cemetery where Zaki is buried is so close to his house that his father always looks at it through the window of his house every day. We asked him to take us to the cemetery where Zaki's grave is located.
The United Nations is also on their side, and so are the so-called human rights groups. The UN and the human rights are just a lie, as they are simply deceiving people. They are more like a mafia, but an official type. They must somehow pay compensation.
1 year has passed since the U.S. pulled its forces out of Afghanistan, ending almost two-decade occupation of the country. Yet no one has stood trial for the tragedy that happened during their withdrawal. There has been neither any compensation nor an apology that could at least calm those who lost their loved ones.
More than 20 people are killed in Libyan capital as clashes erupt between rival armed groups, raising fears of all-out conflict. Health officials say dozens of people were also wounded as gunfire and explosions rocked several districts of Tripoli. There are reports of indiscriminate shelling in civilian-populated neighborhoods. A mosque and a health clinic were reportedly set ablaze. UN's Libya mission has called for an immediate cessation to hostilities. The two rival administrations based in Tripoli and Tobruk are exchanging blame for the violence. The government of national unity, led by Abdulhamid Dbeibah, says fighting broke out after negotiations to avoid bloodshed collapsed. Dbeibah's government was installed in Tripoli last year as part of a UN-led peace process which was supposed to lead to elections. His administration is challenged by a Tobruk-based administration of former Interior Minister Fathi Bashagha. Bashagha is backed by Libya's parliament and eastern-based military strongman Khalifa Haftar. Kiev and Moscow have once again accused one another of shelling Europe's largest nuclear power plant in southern Ukraine. Ukraine's state nuclear company warned of a risk of radioactive leak at the Zaporizhia facility. The company said Russia has repeatedly attacked its infrastructure over the past 24 hours. And Moscow authorities said the Ukrainian forces have attacked the complex 3 times in the same period. On Thursday, the plant was disconnected from the Ukrainian grid for the first time in its history, but the connection was later restored. Disconnecting from the grid may lead to catastrophic failure of cooling systems. Now, Russia captures Zaporizhia in March, but the facility is run by Ukrainian technicians. Iran wraps up the international snipers competition in the city of Yazd. 10-day event brought together teams from armies of seven countries to compete in different shooting fields. Our correspondent, Yusuf Jalali, was there.
The enemy is 600 meters away, and these Russian snipers are zeroing their rifles to take down the target. This is part of the International Snipers Competition, which has been challenging top-grade shooters from seven countries, including Russia, China, and Azerbaijan, in the Iranian city of Yazd. After 10 days of breathtaking competition, the hosting Iranian teams made it to the top of the podium.
Thank God, the Iranian team won the first place. But what's important is that we as the host have maintained the fair play principle, and this is what the participating teams also admitted, that the refereeing was fair and transparent.
The Chinese team claimed the second place, and the Russian Federation and Uzbekistan jointly rounded off the podium in the third place.
We tried our best to win the top of the podium, but the competition was so tight. I hope we will perform better next year.
Before the competition, we thought we could achieve the first place, but the Iranian snipers are so capable and gave us stiff competition.
Organized by the ground force of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the 10-day competition was held in 20 different items, which engaged the snipers in arduous team and individual competitions to test their agility and shooting accuracy in various war conditions.
The competition comprises 20 different items. Some of them are team competitions and others are individual competitions. The contest tries to challenge the competitors' skills in shooting, physical preparedness, and promptitude, among others.
The event came as part of Russia's International Army Games 2022, which hosted over 270 teams from 37 countries and regions. From taking down moving objects to shooting at distant targets, the International Snipers Competition offered a real challenge for some of the select shooters from different countries. So organizers say those who made it to the top are among the most capable shooters in the world. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Yazd.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The fact that global commodity giants are making record profits at a time when hunger is rising is clearly unjust and is a terrible indictment of world food systems. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jessica Corbett, journalist. This article is published under the heading Disaster Capitalism at its Worst. Profits of grain giants spark global criticism. Here's the details.
Oh.
oligopoly in action. That's how Katrick Raj, a Human Rights Watch researcher focused on poverty and inequality in Western Europe, responded recently to The Guardian's new reporting on the world's four grain giants raking in record profits, which is fueling calls for a global windfall tax. After noting United Nations agencies' estimates that while about 345 million people endure acute food insecurity, up over 200 million from before the COVID-19 pandemic, food prices have skyrocketed by over 20%. Journalist Fiona Harvey highlighted remarks from Oliver D. Stutter, a co-chair of International Panel of Experts on Sustainable Food Systems and UN Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights. The fact that global commodity giants are making record profits at a time when hunger is rising is clearly unjust and is a terrible indictment of world food systems, he told Harvey, adding, "What's even worse, these companies could have done more to prevent the hunger crisis in the first place." As Harvey explained, four companies, the Daniels Midland Company, Bung, Cagrill, Louis Dreyfus, known collectively as ABCD, control an estimated 70-90% of the global grain trade. Global grain markets are even more concentrated than energy markets and even less transparent, so there is a huge risk of profiteering, said D. Stutter. He said this year's food price surge happened despite what are thought to be abundant global grain reserves, but there was insufficient transparency from the companies to show how much grain they hold and no way to force them to release stocks in a timely way. We need to be looking at the grain giants and asking what they could have done to avert the crisis and what they could be doing now, D. Stutter said. While the four companies declined to respond to Harvey's request for comment, the Stutter added that ultimately we need to break up the monopolies that have a stranglehold on the food chain. A handful of companies control global seed and fertilizer markets, animal genetics, the global grain trade, and food retail. They are making huge profits at the cost of farmers, consumers, and the environment. Using a term coined by author Naomi Klein, UK climate scientist Bill Maguire declared in response to Harvey's article, "Disaster capitalism at its worst." As 345 million people suffer from acute food insecurity, Maguire continued, "The four corporations that control virtually all grain trade stuff their pockets with cash and laugh all the way to the bank." Nick Dearden, director of the UK-based group Global Justice Now, similarly said that food monopolies rake in bumper profits as speculation drives up food prices. We have enough food for everyone, but the financial markets dictate more and more people must go hungry to fill the coffers of the super wealthy. Workers' wages aren't causing cost of living crisis. Profiteering is, want proof? UNI Global Union tweeted pointing to Harvey's reporting, which details some of what's fueling the current issues. The UK group Plan B Earth-2K met government leaders, Bonanza for fossil fuel companies, while people can't pay their bills, soaring stocks for defense companies on the back of the war. And while famine stocks East Africa and Afghanistan, food companies make record profits. None of us voted for this, they said. As Common Dreams reported in June, Oxfam has spent the summer pushing for a windfall tax targeting major companies. Harvey noted recently that some campaigners and political figures have echoed that demand, including Natalie Bennett, a UK Green Party peer, who said that, as a short-term measure, there are strong arguments for a windfall tax on the food oligopoly. The handful of companies with significant cross-ownership from hedge funds that from seeds to supermarkets are major contributors to the inflation that's driving the cost of living crisis to new highs.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Rouhani and Brother Habib. Sheikh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you for having me.
And Brother Habib, assalamu alaikum to you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Today's topic is how should we prepare ourselves for Arba'in processions and what are the etiquettes. Sheikh Rouhani, let's start with you. First of all, give us a picture of the importance of Arba'in procession or walking.
Yes, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You know, in our riwayat and ahadith, it is mentioned that when Imam al-Asr arwahun afidam, when he reappears, he introduces himself by Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wassalam, saying that I am the son of Imam Hussein, who is martyred while he was thirsty. So this is the الَّذِي قَتَلُوهُ عَطْشَانًا. This is the term that's mentioned, that will be mentioned by Imam al-Asr arwahun afidam. It had been a very important question that how is it possible that Imam Hussein be more popular than Imam al-Asr wa Hunafidah, that Imam al-Asr will introduce himself by Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wassalam.
Okay.
It means that Imam Hussein at that time becomes so much popular among the people of the world that Imam al-Asr wa Hunafidah introduces himself by Imam Hussein.
Yes.
I think nowadays we understand the meaning of this hadith, that this Arba'in march and walking, it becomes year by year so much popular among the people, and millions of people take part to this gathering. And so that's why I think the role of Arba'in is really significant, is really important, because it paves the ground for the reappearance of Imam al-Asr wa Hunafidah.
Even the non-Muslims.
Yeah, of course,
you know, I've heard so many footage of the non-Muslims, Christians, you know, fathers and priests.
Yeah, you know, nowadays I think non-Muslims, and majority of non-Muslims know Arba'in walking.
Yes.
Because it is the most famous walking. It is the most huge gathering of the people in the world.
Yes.
We have no other kind of gathering. Yes.
A more, religious form.
Yeah,
yes.
A religious form in this time. Okay. So that's why I think when we take part to this kind of walking, we must be careful that we are paving the ground for the reappearance of Imam al-Asr wa Hunafidah. And he has a close kind of maybe pay attention to this gathering.
Yes.
And he consider us as those kind of people who is paving the ground for his reappearance.
This is very much different from walking for leisure. Or passing your leisure time, you know, because we have so many processions like walking for so many, or marathon walking, you know, for so many, we can say long, long ways from one place to another place, or processions or demonstrations, you know, all across the world, but or rallies, you know, sometimes. But this one is very much different, as you say, paving the ground for the reappearance of Imam al-Asr. Okay, Habib, what about you? How do you find the Arba'in procession and what is the importance of this Arba'in procession?
The first thing that comes up to my mind is actually why has the Arba'in, out of all the
ziyarats or the pilgrimages towards Imam Hussein alayhi salam, such as the middle of Sha'ban, Al-Rajabiyya, Laylat al-Qadr, Arafah, the nights of Ashura. Why are all these left on one side and then we have Arba'in? It really goes back to the factor of understanding how the Arba'in walk became the Arba'in walk. See, before the students of Najaf, the Hawza of Najaf, used to walk every Wednesday to the shrine of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And then they would go to Kufa. It was like some kind of ritual that they had in the Islamic seminary in Najaf. When Saddam Hussein came to throne, and one of his main goals was actually to kind of put pressure on the Shia sector.
Yes.
One of the pressures was to stop any walking towards the grave of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Our great scholars used to walk during the Arba'in, even though there is no specific narration or hadith that states during Arba'in do walk. There are general sayings about the importance of walking and the rewards of walking to the grave of Imam Hussein, but they're general. They're not specifically talking about the walk of Arba'in.
But we have the story of Jabir ibn Abdullah al-Ansari and his Qulam, you know.
But the thing is that Saddam Hussein tried to turn off the light of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Mm-hmm. And by doing that, he made a fire. Mm-hmm. And like it was like one candle.
Yes.
He tried to turn it off.
Yes.
He dropped the candle and the fire spread.
Uh-huh.
And now one of the biggest pilgrimages towards the grave of Imam Hussein alayhi salam is during the Arba'in. يُرِيدُ أَنْ يَطْفُوا نُورَ اللَّهِ بِأَفْوَاهِهِمْ وَإِبَ اللَّهِ سُبْحَانَهُ وَتَعَالَىٰ أَنْ يُتِمَّ نُورَهُ. They want to turn off the lights of Allah. Yet Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala continues his light, lets his light shine, the lights of guidance shine. And that's what makes Arba'in special. It's a claim that Imam Hussein alayhi salam, his light of guidance will never turn off.
Yes.
And that's the importance. I always say this, there are two imams, three imams you could say, that the Shia have a connection with, a strong connection with,
yes.
like spiritual connection with.
Yes.
Like father, son.
Theme. Yes, yes.
Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, Imam Hussein alayhi salam and Imam al-Kadhim. Imam al-Kadhim, I have specific stories when we talk about him, inshallah ta'ala,
inshallah.
We'll talk about it.
Okay. How should we prepare ourselves for these processions, Sheikh Rouhani? Are there any etiquettes mentioned for this procession? Because nowadays, when you take a look at the Arba'in procession preparations, there are some guidelines given on YouTube or the channels here and there. For example, buy this sack, buy this sandal, you know, have this food, have that food. Are these only the etiquettes or no? There are some spiritual, religious etiquettes in order to prepare ourselves to walk on this way. It seems for religious people and religious, we can say, and spiritual wayfarers, this is a type of spiritual way or a path, it's better to say, to a spiritual development and growth, isn't it?
Of course, yeah. I do agree with the last point that you mentioned. You know, the most important thing here is that to pay attention to the mentality of the people who take part into this gathering. You see, what is our mentality? This is important. You know, if we want to, if we just sometimes tell the people some specific kind of orders or commandments that you have to follow these
yes.
kind of etiquettes, the youth might not accept, might
yes.
not understand it,
yes.
and they might not follow it. I mean, the better way is to tell them or to teach them that why is it important to take part
yes.
into this gathering,
okay.
and what is the spiritual or the immaterial kind of aspect of this
yes.
walking,
yes.
and what should be our intention, what should be our mentality when we are taking part into this gathering. This kind of things, if we clarify these kind of things to the youth, they will be more kind of, let's say, careful while walking in this marsh, or I mean this Arba'in marsh.
Yes.
So that's why the problem is that sometimes we just tell our youth, we just tell our children that you have to do this, you have to do that, and we do not explain for them that what is the reason behind it, and why should they follow this kind of, why should they observe this kind of rulings while they're walking. That's why I think that before going to this Arba'in marsh or before participating in that Arba'in marsh, we have to a little bit study about Imam Hussein, about
yes.
this Arba'in, about
yes.
the importance of Arba'in. And we
to
have
walk
to
with knowledge and
yeah,
ma'rifah.
Course, yeah.
yes.
At least we should be sat
uh-huh.
while walking.
Okay.
Because, yeah, it is commemorating.
Yes. It is a morning session.
Yeah, it's a morning session.
Not
yeah.
a happy celebration.
Of course,
that's
yeah.
all right.
That's it.
Thank you. IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
You know, just recently I've heard a beautiful story. One of the people was talking about the Arba'in procession. He said that I got to one of these, stations on the Arba'in procession. I was sitting down there. An Arab man just come and stood up right across from me. So he was very much close to me. I changed my place and seat. And the Arab just came, just walking in and standing again right across my face. I changed my place for the third time, and then the Arab man came again. And I went to the head of the station over there, asked about this Arab man. Why is he doing that? He said, he is one of the poor men from the tribes of the villages, you know, on the way. He has nothing to share for Imam al-Hussein because he's very much poor. He says, the only thing I can do for Zawar of Imam Hussein is to act like a shadow.
No, no.
To give them shadow.
To give them shadow. See? How much devotion a person must have. You know, sometimes these people are not even themselves because they are close to Karbala, but they are not able to walk. But they spend the time being the shadow for the pilgrim of Imam al-Hussein. You, pilgrim of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, see how much value you have when you are on this path, especially from Najaf to Karbala, because from the other places, the people also come, you know, 2-3 weeks or maybe 1 month earlier, they start the procession towards Karbala. How much devotion do we have and how much devotion must we have, Brother Habib, on this path? How to show our devotion? What to read? What to be busy with?
لا حبيب إلا هو وأهله. إن الإمامة إن الإمام الأبو الرؤوف الرحيم.
Yes.
This is of course مضمون الرواية. The
yes.
Meaning of the saying in Arabic. First one states that there is no loved ones except هو, which is the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, وأهله, and his household.
Yes.
The Imam is the father that is all merciful towards his children. Thirdly, the person does not taste the reality or the truth of Iman or belief unless he is ready to sacrifice his loved ones in the sake of my family.
Yes.
Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasallam, the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. When we see the Shias and how they react and act with the Imams alayhi wasallam, they see them as fathers.
Yes.
We see there are various stories about how they go to the Imam as a father figure. They have a problem with their wife. They go to the Imam. They have a problem that they want to marry someone. They go to the Imam. They have a small problem about cash, small yes. problem about money. They go to the Imam. They have advice about transaction, about life.
Yes.
He's not going to him as an Imam. He's not going to him as a Islamic, the figure that is the for the hereafter. He's going to him as someone that he looks up to. Mm-hmm. And that's the relationship between us and the Imam.
Yes.
The Imam is our everything.
Yes.
The Imam is our everything.
Yes.
We are ready to sacrifice our own selves, our mm-hmm. own sakes, our beloved ones.
Yes.
For the sake of Imam Hussein. And we read this in Ziyarat Ashura. Hopefully the believers who love Imam Hussein alayhi salam recite Ziyarat Ashura every day. And there's this part in Ziyarat Ashura which states that the catastrophe that you went into, right?
Yes.
It has made Islam sorrow. Mm-hmm. It made the people of Islam sorrow. And when I explain this, and when I interpret it, I say put the human being, I don't know if I said it on this program before or another program, okay. but I said it on the
no
radio
problem.
Show, on
no
the radio
problem.
Before.
No problem.
And that is, what is your most happiest point of your life, Sheikhna? What is the most happiest point? When you saw your children,
mm-hmm.
when you bought your house,
okay.
or when you did this or you achieved this.
Yes.
During that time, the happiest moments of your life, let them bring up Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Mm-hmm. And what happened to Imam Hussein alayhi salam? You will cry.
Mm-hmm.
That this happiness will go away. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, there are two stories. One story is that he used to look at the water of Furat. Ma an ghasul aish bi dhikr al Hussein. There's no such thing as happiness when you remember what happened to your beloved Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
Yes.
Another story is that he started crying. It's available in Kamil al-Ziyarat. And we believe that the Imam alayhi salam have this knowledge. They see they are not only the Imam alayhi salam for us, they're the Imam alayhi salam, they're Imam for the jinn as well.
For jinn, that's right.
He says, if you see or if you hear what I see or saw, then you would cry and you would not stop crying. What is that? I heard the jinn and the angels crying and making poems for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. The story of Imam Hussein alayhi salam always connects us. Why? Because there's always this heartbreak.
Yes.
And this heartbreak is something that keeps us connected. This tear that we give towards Imam Hussein alayhi salam not only turns off fire, or what is the reality of it turning off the fires of hell?
Yes.
It is us coming closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It is us closer coming to them alayhum assalam. So
right.
When you go walking towards Imam Hussein alayhi salam, like in Kamil al-Ziyarat, it's available, saying about Imam Sadiq, Zurhu sha'athan ghabaran, hazinan makruban, ju'anan achanan. Visit him while you are dirty, while the sand and dust is on you, while you are hungry and thirsty.
Mm-hmm.
To remember the manner that he was martyred in.
Was martyred, that's right.
And that's something very to keep in mind. The Imam alayhi salam, I believe in this, that they don't always give out the details of the martyrdom or what happened to the after the martyrdom.
Yes.
They have this zine on the woman, and they have this zine towards Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Some things are kind of, you know, kind of this shamed in talking about it. Therefore, they give keys to it. We say, visit him hungry and thirsty. What does it mean?
Uh-huh.
It means he died hungry and thirsty.
Yes.
Keep that in your mind when you walk.
Yes.
And do not walk for the sake of people are walking. The Shias are walking.
Mm-hmm.
Walk for the sake of Imam Hussein.
Imam Hussein,
that's
right.
This is the saying. Can I please say
okay,
it?
Okay.
Very
no
sorry, Hajj Aghab.
No
it's a very
go
beautiful
ahead.
Thing
go
that
ahead.
I read to actually a couple of weeks back.
Very good.
I've always asked myself, on the Day of Judgment, what will we eat? What will we eat on the Day of Judgment? Because I read to this saying about Imam Baqir alayhi salam in the verse, يوم تبدل الأرض غير الأرض, that the earth will turn into bread.
Yes.
And there are rivers. So people will eat bread and water during the entire Day of Judgment. Except for the visitors of Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
Mm-hmm.
Why? There's this saying, من زار الحسين حباً له حباً لرسول الله, for the sake of the love of the Prophet, for the sake of the love of Fatima al-Zahra, for Ahlul Kisa al-Khamsa, the five Ahlul Kisa, he will eat from the stable spreads of heaven while the people are during judgment.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something to get, something to gain while visiting. When you go for the love of Hussein,
yes.
Go for the love of the Prophet, go for the love of Fatima al-Zahra, therefore you will get this reward
that's
on
right.
The Day of Judgment. You won't have to eat bread on the Day of Judgment. You will eat from the table spread of heaven.
That's all right. Alhamdulillah, may Allah give us the chance, you know, of taking part in the Arba'in procession, as you said, with a broken heart, for the sake of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. It is not a leisure time. It is not for amusement. It is a way for a spiritual wayfaring, a spiritual growth towards Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, you know, on the day of Arba'in. May Allah give us the chance, inshallah. Thank you much, Shaykh, and thank you much, Brother Habib, about the importance of the day of Arba'in and what are the etiquettes to that. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. If you listen to our program and you may find a chance to attend in the Arba'in procession, do not forget us in your prayers and du'as and supplications on this way toward Karbala. Till another episode, fi amanillah, assalamu alayka ya Aba Abdullah al-Husayn.
Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Li Aliyin wa Husayn wa Hasan. لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website,
www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. The world's top four grain traders, which have dominated the global grain market for decades, have seen record or near-record profits or sales. They are forecasting demand to outstrip supply at least until 2024, which is likely to lead to even higher sales and higher profits in the next 2 years. We now present you an article written by Fiona Harvey. The piece is titled, Record Profits for Grain Firms Amid Food Crisis Prompt Calls for Windfall Tax. Companies at the center of the global grain trade have enjoyed a record bonanza amid soaring food prices around the world, raising concerns of profiteering and speculation in global food markets that could put staples beyond the reach of the poorest and prompting calls for a windfall tax. The world's top four grain traders, which have dominated the global grain market for decades, have seen record or near-record profits or sales. They are forecasting demand to outstrip supply at least until 2024, which is likely to lead to even higher sales and higher profits over the next 2 years. According to the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, food prices have surged more than 20% this year. According to the World Food Programme, WFP, about 345 million people are experiencing acute food insecurity, compared with 135 million people before the COVID-19 pandemic. Olivier de Schutter, a co-chair of the IPES Food, the International Panel of Experts on Sustainable Food Systems, IPES Food, and United Nations Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights, said, "The fact that global commodity giants are making record profits at a time when hunger is rising is clearly unjust and is a terrible indictment of our food systems. What's even worse, these companies could have done more to prevent the hunger crisis in the first place." Four companies, the Archer Daniels Midlands Company, Bunge, Cargill and Louis Dreyfus, known collectively as ABCD, control an estimated 70 to 90% of the global grain trade. Olivier de Schutter, the co-chair of the International Panel of Experts on Sustainable Food Systems, said, "Global grain markets are even more concentrated than energy markets and even less transparent, so there is a huge risk of profiteering." Olivier de Schutter said this year's food price surge happened despite what are thought to be abundant global grain reserves, but there was insufficient transparency from the companies to show how much grain they hold and no way to force them to release stocks in a timely fashion. Olivier de Schutter added, We need to be looking at the grain giants and asking what they could have done to avert the crisis and what they could be doing right now. Cargill reported a 23% increase in revenues to a record $165 billion for the year ending 31st of May, while Archer Daniels Midland made the highest profit in its history during the second quarter of this year. Sales at Bunge surged by 17% year-on-year in the second quarter, though its profits were affected by previously incurred charges. Louis Dreyfus reported profits for 2021 up by more than 80% on the previous year, as revenues rose by nearly a quarter to $1.62 billion. John Rogers, an analyst at the credit rating service Moody's, said, "It was not surprising that supply constraints and rebounding demand had increased food prices and led to higher profits." John Rogers claimed, "I don't think they're colluding for outsized profits," adding that many more companies were also taking an increasing share of global grain markets. John Rogers claimed, "I don't think they're acting immorally. They're not intentionally driving up prices." He said the profits for grain companies had been increasing overall, but their margins had not markedly increased in percentage terms, adding, "This is a relatively efficient market. I don't think these guys can ramp up the prices." However, unpublished analysis by a non-governmental organization seen by The Guardian suggests that some food companies may be increasing their profit margins too. The analysis found Archer's Daniel Midland increased its profit margin to 4.46% in the first quarter of this year, up from 3.65% in the same quarter in 2021. And Cargill's profit margin increased from 2.5% last year to 3.2% this year. Sandra Martinson, a policy manager at Bond, a network of international development charities, said a windfall tax would be a way to restore some balance to food markets and help the poorest. Sandra Martinson said, "The big agri-food companies are clearly capitalizing on the reduced supply and increased demand, further exacerbated by commodity trading." She added, "When supply is significantly lower than demand, it gives space for price increases. But this is also exacerbated by speculative stock markets, since wheat and other commodities are traded in stock markets and therefore prices fluctuate." Oxfam has also called for a windfall tax on food companies' profits. Alex Maitland, a senior advisor at Oxfam, said, "There are fears that speculation could be a driver in food price rises. Anything that causes hunger and starvation is immoral." Natalie Bennett, a UK Green Party peer, joined the call. She said, "As a short-term measure, there are strong arguments for a windfall tax on the food oligopolies. The handful of companies with significant cross-ownership from hedge funds and from seeds to supermarkets are major contributors to the inflation that's driving the cost of living crisis to new heights." Vicky Hurd, the head of sustainable farming at the UK food coalition Sustain, stopped short of calling for a windfall tax, as she said it was hard to separate out the price effects in supermarkets where consumers buy most of their food. But she called for the British government to regulate to stop abuse. She said, "While farmers, consumers and food workers are suffering in the face of spiralling food prices and fuel prices, those sitting in the middle of the food chain, a small number of huge dominant grain traders, are raking in vast profits." Sandra Martinson said if government rejects a windfall tax, they should consider other means to curb prices, including price caps or tighter regulation on commodity trading, such as the ban on commodity trading introduced in India to limit inflation and price hikes. Sandra Martinson said Food companies and commodity speculators were also blamed for fueling the food price rises seen more than a decade ago, when surging prices led to riots in many countries. The causes of the food price rises are complex. The war in Ukraine has played a big part, as Ukraine is one of the world's top producers of grain, sunflower oil, maize, and fertilizer. The war sent food prices soaring to their highest ever levels in March, though some have fallen back slightly since then. A standoff with Russia over moving grain shipments from Ukraine for export has been partially resolved, and some shipments have now moved. But harvests from Ukraine and Russia will be affected this year as well as next year. Rising energy and fertilizer prices, which have also spiraled due to Russia's special operation in Ukraine, have an impact, while the rebound in demand after COVID lockdowns has added further pressure. Grain harvests in Europe, in North America and India have also been affected by the climate crisis. Last year's heat waves in Canada hurt wheat crop yields in Canada, and high temperatures and wildfires this year are likely to inflict damage. This all adds up to a rosy picture for grain producers. Demand for their product is surging, supplies are constrained, and despite rising input prices in the form of energy and fertilizer, their profits look secure. The Guardian contacted all four of the ABCD companies for comment, but has not received any replies. Olivier de Schutter said, "Ultimately, we need to break up the monopolies that have a stranglehold on the food chain. A handful of companies control global seed and fertilizer markets, animal genetics, the global grain trade, and food retail. They're making huge profits at the cost of farmers, at the cost of consumers and the environment." In Britain, food prices have risen for many staples, adding to woes over energy prices that are set to top £3,500 a year this winter for the average British household. Poverty campaigners have warned people are facing harsh choices this winter over whether to eat or to heat their homes.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.